Welcome to the Intercut Podcast Channel, the weekly place to hear the latest on movies, TV, and entertainment that people can't cut away from. I am your co-host, Zachary Shevich, and joining me, up, up, and away, it's Arturo Zurita.
Imagine I just start floating here like crazy. I don't know if you've seen those Dune trailers, but there's been a lot of floating in the media we've been seeing nowadays. It's too
there's
much
something
floating.
In the culture, something in the water. Yeah.
You know, he's talked about Wonka in the past for some of his projects, but this was the wonkiest of them all, I will say, when it comes to Nathan Fielder.
Yeah, Nathan Fielder, a person who you and I have had a lot of time for in his different creative iterations recently, is found a new evolution in this limited series from him and Benny Safdie, co-starring Emma Stone on Showtime. I think just one of the most interesting shows that we've had in quite a while. Both of us had it on our top 10 lists of last year. I had seen the finale back then. I don't think you had.
And, I had not.
I think, and most people had not. It aired in early 2024, and it made waves of sorts, or maybe it should say it took off in a certain way. I think a lot of people were discussing the show in a way they hadn't been in the weeks prior, because it's certainly one of the most singular and mysterious things that a TV show has done in quite a while. But before we talk about specifically how The Curse ended, I think we should talk at least briefly about what The Curse did for its first 9.5 episodes. Because for those first 9.5 episodes, it was a very interesting comedy of sorts that got really uncomfortable with certain questions around appropriation, consumerism, voyeurism, just a whole bunch of pet ideas that Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie have toyed with in their other projects. So I just want to start out with this. For the first 9.5 episodes of The Curse, what did you think of it as a TV show?
It was good. Top 10 material, like you said.
Yeah.
I thought his approach to it and having a narrative and where he's approaching a lot of the things that he's done in his show with the businesses, when he's been playing a persona of some sorts, being able to make it into a narrative, I thought was really good, because a lot of people were surprised by how good of an actor he was. You could see it in the reality shows that he did. But putting it into a character, I think, showcases not only how great of an actor he is, but I think how easily people get duped. Because seeing it as a character, people were scared of it. And I found that funny. Because then that means you never saw him acting in his other stuff. And you're wrong.
Exactly. Like, Nathan Fielder does this really interesting thing where he likes to blend the boundaries between what is real, what is fiction, what is me, and what is a character or a characterized version of me, right? Because we've been introduced to Nathan Fielder in several different ways, but how much of what we've been introduced to is actually Nathan Fielder, and how much of it is him putting on some kind of performance? And I agree with you. I think that, like, pretty much from the start, he's been doing this very interesting, nuanced performance of a guy. Like, I don't think he's ever really showing us the real Nathan Fielder, maybe in glimpses, but it is all
even if it's a facade.
Yeah, it's all very, very carefully crafted for his comedy and for trying to get at the certain feelings that he evokes with this specific brand of kind of like uncomfortable cringe comedy. And I think you get a lot of that with this show too, whether it's like the arguments that devolve into shouting matches between him and Emma Stone, which are played not really for the laughs, but are played for the reality, the discomforting reality of those moments. He's a very brave performer. You know,
I would say so.
I think you can look at something even as silly as like the sex scene between him and Emma Stone, where they're like using the toy or whatever. And it's a kind of scene where I think there's a lot of actors out there who would not have the like lack of reservations to do a scene like that in a way that feels kind of real and cringily authentic.
Well, like you're saying, if he's doing that scene already, what precedes that scene? Being told by his father-in-law, you have a tiny penis. Welcome to the tiny penis gang. Like, if he already believes that people are going to stop, bro, that people are going to already assume some of him in that character, why go ahead and say, and my character has a small penis? Like, I think he is not afraid. You're calling him brave. Yeah, he is so beyond that, because all of this uncomfortableness is to lead you to a truth. Mm-hmm. That's what I think he does best in comedies, that he's leading you to a truth in all the shows that he's done. Even when he's dealing with real people at a business, to being a completely fictional reality show that he's doing in this one. I think every single thing that he does is because he's trying to get you into a perspective that other people have not seen.
Right. And here they sort of take their aims at this specific type of like white, liberal, progressive capitalist that is sort of using the facade of being a do-gooder and being charitable to launch themselves as a brand and launch their own capitalistic venture that isn't going to live up to the values that they try to say out loud. You know, they try to portray themselves consistently. The characters of Asher and Whitney, they try to portray themselves as these really like forward thinking, charitable, kind do-gooders who don't want to just take advantage of community. They want to uplift a community and
they want to tell the community what they're doing and how they're doing.
Yeah.
They don't want to help. They want to tell you how they're helping.
Exactly. They are people who have so kind of like Jedi mind tricked themselves into believing that they are like the positive change that can exist in the world, that they no longer do things because they are the right thing to do. They do them in the hopes that they can be, can be chronicled, can be distributed by HGTV. You know, there's that really... I thought hilarious moment in the final episode when they go to the house that they had lent to Abshir, the character played by Barkhad Abdi. And
fantastic.
Asher is hoping, it's a really fantastic kind of like non-performance, as I think he's like particularly great at doing.
And there's commentary in there too.
Yeah, yeah. But that whole moment where Asher is hoping for this to be this kind of, moment where he can get that dopamine rush of being thanked for how thoughtful and how caring he is and how charitable he is and show off to his wife about what a good person that she's inspired him to become. And he's just interested in the practical reality of, well, if you're giving me the house, then who's going to pay for the taxes? And can you also give me the money to pay for the taxes? And can you get off my property? Cause you're not my friend. You're my landlord. Mm-hmm. It just to me is such a funny like bursting of their bubble over and over again.
Yeah. It was a total of 9 episodes or 10?
10.
That's what the first 9 episodes did. And that's why it didn't matter what the finale did. It was going to be in my top 10 because it got that down perfectly. What is it? What's the phrase? When you're socially something, but you're fiscally conservative?
Socially liberal, fiscally conservative. Yeah.
Is this the textbook definition of that?
Absolutely.
And then you brought it to the point of what people don't understand is like, how do they not see it? And I think what the show like really relished in was that idea of like, no, these people are so far gone. There is no fixing it. They are right. Even in the problem that they think they're going to create, right? These people are trying to fix something while all their funding comes from her parents that she's trying to stay away from. And, you're over there and I don't even deal with them in their business and whatever. Daddy, actually, I need however much money it is.
Yeah.
What's that line he says? I'm going to come to the bank so we can get it at a reoccurring thing. She said this is the first time he looked at her like. She said it's a loan, he said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's a cherry tomato boy. He knows right from, he knows the truth when he hears it.
Yeah,
that's what the show got down perfectly that I think a lot of other people who may have approached it maybe felt like a pushback from it. There's been other stuff that we've covered, like When You're Finished Saving the World is a perfect example of someone being so on themselves that they are the people doing good and anything in the way has become like this biblical thing. Oh, they're in my way because I'm doing something so right. They can never be wrong. And that's what this show does perfectly is that it shows you how far gone they are. I don't think there was fixing any of them. It's almost like they had a head full of air and unless it burst or they flew up, nothing else was going to happen. I love everything in those 9 episodes before they took that crazy turn, right? You could end a series on HBO in so many different ways. And I was not expecting it, but as we get closer to the ending, I really love that take that they took. Because the 9 episodes already had everything going for it. You could have given me a generic type of ending where they get caught or whatever. The almost metaphorical way that they took it and the absurdity of it was beautiful for this ending. And yeah, I thought his performance and his approach and what you said with Abdi's character was interesting, because they are looking not to do things for the betterment, but you called it a dopamine hit. And it's this idea that they're only doing it just because they want to have that level up. There's that meme that goes around about when someone wants to, or the Oprah meme. Oprah gives you a car, but then you're stuck paying taxes with it, just like Abdi's character was saying. I even think the casting of him is something that they were using to their favor. I think Abdi is someone who is in the same realm as Yalitza from Roma, where they hired them for playing a character that was so close to them that it's almost insulting what the Academy is doing, because their next performances are no longer good. It was almost like they weren't chosen because they were performing, but because they fit the role so well. And then all of a sudden, they're no longer an actor. I thought this was him finding a way to cast him, almost as proving that point in and of itself. I think there's a meta element to that that I thought was pretty good. And it goes as far as, and we get deeper to it, with the actress who played the artist.
Yes,
and how they approach
that was what I was gonna. That's what I was gonna respond with, because they did a lot of rewriting on this show after casting certain actors, or casting, rewriting after they realized who they wanted to cast. Because you mentioned they cast Bakrat Abdi, then they were searching for girls to play his daughter, and they loved both of those girls. They ended up casting that one daughter ended up becoming two daughters on the show.
Ooh, nice! Yeah, that's sick.
Yeah,
I'm going to compare this to the finish your point.
No, just going to say their ability to roll with the cast and kind of play to their strengths, I think, is something that is really, really evident. I mean, I thought those two little girls were both so, so excellent. Just like,
bro,
they felt completely real.
Yeah.
But yeah, the artist that they brought, the indigenous artist they brought in too, I thought had a lot of really interesting things to say that they ended up incorporating into the show.
I think people get confused when it comes to filmmakers approaching something like Killers of the Flower Moon had that big one of, this is where the script started. It's like, but that's not where it ended. I'm very confused why you're judging a draft, really, right? To me, that shows that they're listening. And I don't think people get that, because again, it's almost like they're the characters in the show. Oh, well, they didn't do it right from the beginning. I was like, oh, you don't actually want to do good. You live in this pretend world where you don't think you've made a flaw. What I see are creators who do care. In Killers of the Flower Moon, they didn't have it. How were they supposed to create something they don't know? But when they talked to them, all of the actresses from Lily Gladstone to everybody else added to that role. Like you're saying here, the moment they cast the artist, it's not that they didn't have lines for her. It's that when the moment she came up to them and said, this would be done differently, the fact they listen says everything you need to know. That is why I like
exactly.
Show. Other shows won't do that. Other shows will tell them what they're supposed to be or no, we're approaching it from this way. You don't understand your character. At that point, you're the two leads in this series.
So yeah, I appreciated that. Apparently, Nizhonia Austin, the woman who plays that artist we were talking about, she improvised that line about the meaning of the turning turkey slicing during her audition, and they liked it so much they put it in the show.
Nah, bro. I think that scene alone is probably one of the big scenes that you can take out with the adjacent scenes around it and be like, this is the premise of the show. It's this.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, it's a scene that ends up being a microcosm for the larger project. And it's like so interesting that it ends up being this thing that they actually didn't write, that they borrowed from the actress. But I think it highlights the exact same thing that you mentioned, that one of the things that makes them so good as artists is their ability to listen. And their ability to react. I mean, you can take Nathan Fielder's previous projects. All of those succeed because of his ability to react to the people involved in them, right? He because they're reality based, he really has to go with the people and adjust his vision, and it's something that is like an incredible skill that they've been able to, you know, bring across to the narrative world as well.
And the way he's able to get those awkward moments too, because you can have something like the rehearsal, right, where he's able to build this awkward situation, he's like the one acting but the other person is genuine. God bless Emma Stone and this man. First off, we have Emma Stone where in terms of acting?
I mean, at least of her generation, I feel like she's kind of the GOAT right now. I mean, Margot Robbie might be the only one kind of like holding a candle to her right now, but I'm not sure I could see Margot Robbie do this.
But even Margot didn't even get that nomination, did she? She's a shoo-in to win for me. Why is he acting alongside her and going toe-to-toe? My hat's off to you, sir. Yeah, there is that one scene, and I already know you know it, when they do something so awkward, you're like, that was really weird. And then they're like, this is a really good moment of taking off the shirt. Let's reenact it. And you go, whoa, you can cut. Like, the way he approached that was what Instagram comedy thinks they're getting every single time, but they just looked like the cringy version of it. How he was able to, like, get it right the first time.
Yeah.
And then dig deep into the awkwardness of trying to reenact it. And then he's truly acting within the performance of, what would I have done to make this natural? You're like, but how did you get it natural the first time? So impressive, man. It is so,
yeah, it's layers.
Just off a technical level, it's mm-hmm. good.
It's,
and then to
it's
get
layers
all these
to
meanings
it.
Into it, I think it's one of the best things that he's done, truly. We haven't yeah. even talked about Safdie.
Right, which is he's genuinely becoming like one of my favorite character actors at this point. Like, I know,
so can we say it then?
The accent is quite goofy in Oppenheimer. It still kind of works for me. I think he's excellent in his smaller roles in like stuff like Licorice Pizza or Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. But he is really so believable as Dougie here, just like this trashy guy who kind of has like this sweet side to him underneath it too. I love this performance from Benny.
They're really good at playing characters who you should not like and then somehow mm-hmm. get you to be like, ah, if I just met you without knowing all that other garbage, I probably would hang out with you for the day, wouldn't I? Mm. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know mm-hmm. if you saw that picture that they said they based that character on. It was some reality producer. I'm going to have to send it to you afterwards.
That's so funny.
Take. I was like, yo, can you sue? It was really close. We got to say it now. You know, we were talking about the Coen brothers splitting and who had what, who had the Jews, who had, you know, this style compared to that style. These are two brothers who have kind of split. We've been saying
Josh
one
and
of them
Benny,
sticking
yeah.
to directing. One of them is not. But one of them is following what he wanted to do. And I think every character that they've played has been impressive. They're all separate yeah. from each other. I think the other Safdie's on the clock, bro. I got to see him.
That's the thing. It's like I'm not happy about the split because I loved when they worked together, but it's hard to argue against Benny's career arc right now where he's getting
right?
to act in like all these amazing movies from amazing no. auteurs and
I can't hate that.
Collaborate with one of the most exciting names in comedy on one of the most interesting shows that we got in the past couple of years.
Right.
So yeah, it's
and then
hard,
what?
It's hard
he comes
to...
back to direct? And he's going to come back as a juggernaut? Like, I only yeah. see good things here. Please take your yeah. break. Act in everything you want because I've been impressed. So
I just need that Adam Sandler sports cards trading movie with Megan Thee Stallion to still happen. So please still happen.
That's a thing?
Apparently, that was the next movie they were working on before the split. So I don't know.
Oh, damn. He's still starring yeah. it. I mean,
yeah.
But no, he... Overall, I thought he was at a very impressive part to the moving piece as almost being the instigator from the outside because yeah. he's also coming in trying to make the show what he thinks is going to be what sells. And he's almost slipping mm-hmm. things to her and not to him. And he just does a lot of weird things. You're catching him with yeah. other people's phones. He's digging things.
One of the things that's sort of like a strange little undercurrent that doesn't get brought up much is that Asher and Benny's character have this previous relationship. They're childhood friends. And it feels like throughout the show, Benny is trying to get back at Asher for something in their past. Or
Dougie
is.
The real curse?
Yeah, and maybe it is. We can start to talk about the finale in a second. But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because the arc of Dougie is sort of he ends up doing these things to sabotage himself and then realizing he's sabotaging himself and gets very sad about it. And you can't help but feel kind of sad for him.
But that's also like another layer to that type of person.
Yes,
there are
yes.
two leads and then him. It's like this self-sabotaging that you're doing to yourself. I don't like... When we recommended this, some people went to go watch it. And then I got texts going, why? And I went, I always say watch the trailer because if you're not into space movies and I recommend a space movie, the space movie's not going to be bad just because you don't like it.
Yeah.
This is about miserable people and you just have to be in that state of mind. And maybe I should say that while I think this is his best, you should probably start with something like his show. Then maybe the rehearsal. Yeah. To ease your way into this, because these are very unlikable people. And I think when you're watching a show on, if you even have it, Showtime or Paramount, it's difficult to be like, I don't get what I'm supposed to like in these people. This is Emma Stone. I'm used to liking her. You're coming at it. Yeah. I think it's a show that you do need a little prefacing for if you're
and
an average
audience. It's also a pretty inscrutable show, the ending more so than the rest of the season. But the rest of the season, too, it's not exactly like a show that comes out and tells you this is what it's about. This is sort of like the clean character arc. This is what our cast of friends learned this week. It's a little bit difficult. It's a little bit messy, but it is so... it's so dense with these ideas and these themes, and it's not a surprise that like this is one of the few TV shows that has ever been part of the New York Film Festival. Like it does have a very filmic feel to it. I really, really love the way they shot this too. They used a lot of extremely long lenses in order to give the whole thing this kind of voyeuristic quality. Like you're observing these moments that maybe you shouldn't. Little like almost like glimpses of accidental behind the scenes footage. With these cameras that were so far away from the actors, they often didn't know where the cameras were. And I think it's
like Blackberry, sort of, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I think it adds a very dramas. Kind of like uncomfortable, candid camera quality to it.
And then you get those weird, the cursed opening title morphs.
Yes,
and it just
yes.
sets this tone, dude.
Yeah.
There's so many elements. Let me get some threads over here. When we first see him, he is working for a casino, and it turns out that he had such a bad interview, he's willing to throw the casino people under the bus, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to go hack some, like, information to be able to give it away so that they give him back that tape. And in there, there's, like, this breakdown of him being responsible for the gambling addictions that are spreading around. There's that one image when they're walking, right, where I think it's, like, supposed to be this almost, like, meme portrait.
Yes, the...
Do you know what I'm talking about? Because I don't want to misquote it.
No, it's something like an image of a casino, and there's two indigenous people standing there, and one says to the other, like, if only we had invented the casinos earlier, or something like that.
It was like this flashback of like how they were used back then, but they got them back now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like so much to say there, because even in that, I do think it's critiquing that method. You do have your own at the casino still, too. So you end up being just like the character of Safdie, who is shooting himself in the foot, thinking you're getting somebody back.
Right, right.
It's really profound. Like, there's so many layers to this. There's one, just instances. I don't even know what else this means other than the guy who he screws over when he sees him at the store. Nothing.
Oh.
Nothing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Nothing until he's in front of somebody else that he needs to play nice. Oh, sorry. How you doing? I don't even think he says sorry. He just says, oh, hey. And then completely ignores them out there. Just those interactions that he's been doing and gathering, I feel, talking to real people for so long. What a master to put it in these performances, right?
Yeah.
We haven't even mentioned that he's technically not even a director. The directors are the Zellner Bros.
He directed some of the episodes, but the Zellners directed...
Oh, okay, my bad.
Yeah, the directors...
Well, there you go, just that mix between the two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Zellners did some as well.
They did Sasquatch. We will be bringing them up for another movie in our Coen Bracket thing. And those two, I think, just have an angle at comedy and uncomfortableness that, like, what a melting pot to get all of these people into one.
We should also mention that your boy, Brigsby Bear director Dave McCary, is one of the writers on this show, one of the producers on this show.
Because he's married?
To Emma Stone, yeah.
What's their company again? I always
Fruit Tree.
Fruit Tree. Really good movies at Sundance. They did Brigsby Bear, like Zach just said. They were hitting on all cylinders with this. Like you were saying, they went out to make a massive movie, came out with 10 parts of it. And I think they made a killer team, dude. This is a really good team.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk more specifically about that finale, because it is one of the most unique episodes of TV I feel like we've seen in a while, one of the most inscrutable and daring season finales, series finales we've had in a while. You know, it's rare that a show makes this bold of a swing with this little attempt to kind of explain itself. They seem to be like enjoying the sort of collective throwing up their arms at this ending and beating their heads against the wall trying to figure out what it is. I've seen some interviews and some of the talks that Benny has done afterward, and they're very like coy about talking about what they feel like happened at the ending. They want it to be open to interpretation. I think there's lots of ways to interpret it. But the main thing is Nathan Fielder's character Asher floats off into space. They spend the entire last half hour of that finale on this extended, really impressive set piece, we should probably mention, in which Nathan Fielder is either on the ceiling of their house or then hanging on barely to a tree before he floats off into space. There's a lot of ways we can tackle talking about this. Do you want to talk about it just as a like practical achievement of filmmaking? Do you want to talk about the literal explanation of what happened? Or do you want to get straight into like metaphorically, what does this all mean? What are they trying to tell us?
I want to start with why the episode started with freaking 20 minutes on being on the Rachel Ray show.
Which isn't a show anymore. They like brought her back just for this bit.
I thought they duped her and Rachel Ray was going to release on Wednesday two actors that she had no idea were actors.
Yeah, I was not expecting this. All of a sudden, we get a little bit like a time jump until... It's been after the first season of their show has aired and they're picked up for a second. But yeah, they are the guests on a Rachel Ray program where they're not even getting that much time or attention.
Yeah, because what's the name of the Sopranos?
Yeah, gotta listen to just, Pussy's Meatball Recipe.
They just dedicated it for like 15 minutes. And I'm like, are you saying this is your last episode?
Mm-hmm.
What a primer. What a primer to this man floating away.
Well, it kind of does set the table in a weird way because it goes on for so long and it gets so uncomfortable. Especially there's that moment right before they cut where they're just – it shows them in their living room being, you know – patched in through Zoom or whatever, and it sits on them quiet for like it feels like half a minute almost.
Yeah,
and I think it kind of sets the stage for this like extended discomfort that the finale gives you.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I think it sets you up perfectly. So let's talk about the technical side of it because I agree with you. I think the way that they had them out there, you and I were kind of tossing different things out there. You think they built it? I think you said wires. I said the way his stuff moved. It had to be some Inception stuff.
I was convinced that they're doing a lot of this with ropes because the way he moves, it kind of looked like pulleys to me. But one thing they did reveal in some of those Q&As they've had is that they did build a reverse room for this.
Told you.
And that all of the interiors they've shot all season long were on a stage because they knew they were leading up to this moment and they wanted it to look consistent. So, yeah, there is a reverse room going on, although I have to assume they're using wires for some of that outdoor stuff because I don't think you could – I don't know how you would achieve some of that stuff.
He floated away, Zach.
He actually floated away. That one
it had to be, yeah. If you haven't seen the stuff from Inception, and I hope they release the stuff for this.
But just
there's so many more edges.
The fact that
Inception
we can...
is a square.
Right.
This was a house, bro.
Yeah.
He was getting into nooks and crannies. That's where you go as a viewer. And then she's coming in?
Well, that's the thing, is they're able to simultaneously have both of them on screen, and then there's even moments where they're handing stuff off to each other. There's that incredible moment where they're literally hanging on to each other, which I don't even know how they managed to pull that off.
Just pure witchcraft.
And the fact that it is so, like, unanswerable, I think speaks to just the level of technical achievement here. Like, it looks incredible, and it because there you don't see the seams, you don't see the ropes attached to them, you don't see, oh, that's obviously upside down, it makes it that much more terrifying.
And the fact that you were never expecting a VFX freaking finale.
Right. It is this gigantic left turn during a show, which while there have been some like allusions to potential like magical elements with the curse and the missing chicken and stuff like that, nothing quite as grandiose as this.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of it when it first happened?
I mean, I was just absorbed in it because it's so tense. Like you get that like discomfort in your body and the tingly sensation. And I was sort of just waiting and on the edge of my seat. When he floats away in the end, I have to admit that I was like very puzzled because it's such a sudden departure for the show in terms of, you know, like we were saying, how it's played out, the tone of it thus far. But, you know, it sticks with you, right? Like it's so viscerally terrifying that you kind of, I kind of felt it in my body for a little bit.
And you were hanging out?
Yeah, right. Like, and I kept puzzling it over and turning it over in my head and thinking about it. And I think what I like a lot about it is it does really lend itself well to interpretation, that you can kind of say that it means several things. There's many ways to make it make metaphorical sense. There's some ways to try and make it make practical sense if you want that too. But I think what's just exciting about it is that it like, it's so unexpected, right? Like it just, I love the way that Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie have been able to catch me by surprise through their previous works. And this is like the ultimate testament to that, because they lull you into a false sense of comfort and then they give you this like really, really electric sequence.
That's not us being hipsters.
Maybe it is
we
us being hipsters
new,
a little bit
so
too.
They did it right,
and maybe it is us being hipsters a little bit too, but honestly I'm okay with that. You know, we see there's so many finales where we sit here and we argue, did they nail it, did they
land it, yeah,
stick the landing? You know, we talked about Succession on this podcast, and I think that's one of the great finales of all time. People still are like, I don't know about, should Shiv have really done that, blah blah blah. But this is almost like such a daring,
it doesn't let you though,
it's like such a daring ending that I don't think you can even argue
the Monopoly
about it
table.
Yeah, but exactly,
that I'm only like approaching, I like,
please,
it, but
please,
I just want to make
advocate.
Sure, are we not just like if they're creators and they've done so much stuff that they just threw it at the whiteboard.
Mm-hmm.
So they like it because it's different and we like it because it's different. But that's what gets the mainstream audience to be like, you just wanted something different.
I think there's two ways I would respond to that. One, sure, there's some aspects of it that I'm excited about because it's different, but it's also that it's so well done, right? Like it's not just about being different, but it is about, in a moment to moment basis, I am completely engrossed. I'm completely with the show. I really want to know how are they going to try and resolve it. So that's one. And the other way I would argue that is that I don't think it's meaningless. And even if I don't know what the exact meaning is, I think I can still take a lot away from it. That even if it's just the base emotions that it leaves me with, I'm profoundly affected by it in a way that lesser shows just aren't able to get at. They just aren't able to upset me or disturb me or make me think about them as long as this show has.
It was a lot of effort for that finale set piece for it to just be a random.
Right.
So let's break it down then. Yeah. I want to start practically before we get metaphorically. Yes. Practically. I thought it was the house. I thought, you see, this is what happens when you make these crappy houses. I thought
you was thought like, the same thing that Asher did, that the pressure was off and they had to.
The pressure was off. This is what happens when it stabilizes for the temperature.
Yeah.
Then he went outside and I was just like, that's where I don't know where this is going.
Yeah, I was
so
with you. I think I thought it was the house at first too.
So practically, what could you possibly give a viewer who liked the reality of this and needs to go,
right,
what happened?
Right. Okay. So there's a couple potential practical explanations. And granted, none of them are like bound by earthly science. I can't give you that explanation. But there's a couple things within the show that would at least point to it. For one, the episode 8 ending that has that uncomfortable car ride home between Asher and Dougie, where they have that sort of awkward dinner together. And Asher is leaving the car. Dougie sort of swats at a fly, says it's a fly. Asher leaves, and under his breath, Dougie goes, "I curse you." Now, we don't know what the curse was that Dougie was putting on Asher. Maybe it was that he's floating away. Maybe it's that he said the word fly, so he was thinking he can fly away, something like that. But, you know, this has been a thing running throughout the show, is that Dougie is kind of while he's working with Asher, he's also kind of trying to screw Asher over. And mm-hmm. that guilt that he feels in that moment after Asher flies away, when he just, you know, collapses into tears, sort of points toward
a feeling
of guilt on his part.
Okay.
Now, granted, that's a very natural response to somebody dying or getting hurt.
Floating,
you know,
away into the atmosphere.
Right. No, but like that's something that humans do, is where like somebody, you know, dies of cancer and you blame yourself for not being there more or something like that. Right.
But he kind of has a
more direct correlation So that's one way that you could think about the practical.
Because you're saying he didn't look confused, like, why is my buddy floating though? Like, his buddy didn't die. It's like, but why this way?
Right.
He felt okay.
Exactly. He felt guilty. There's also the ending of episode 9 where Dougie, Whitney, and Asher all get together in their hotel room to watch the cut of the first episode. And Whitney insists that Dougie show the sort of marital troubles cut that didn't ultimately make it into the final episode, the Green Queen version of their show, in which they've sort of done reality TV trickery to make it look like Asher and Whitney's relationship is in trouble and that Whitney would be better off without him. And in that big confrontation that happens afterward, one of the things that Asher says to her is, if you didn't want to be with me and I actually truly felt that, I'd be gone. You wouldn't have to say it. I would feel it and I would disappear.
That's the closest one.
Yeah. And there is sort of like this feeling that like in that moment, the moments right before Whitney is going to give birth to their baby and kind of divert her love and admiration towards a new child, that she doesn't need him anymore, that she doesn't love him anymore. And that because he feels that, he's being literally sucked away from her life, like pulled out of her life completely. Now that's a little bit metaphorical as well, but that is another way to look at why did this happen to Asher, right?
Yeah. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't see why this town would randomly have a floating person still. But metaphorically, I got the same thing that you're getting at there. It's like the moment the kid comes into the picture, he realizes he's done.
Yeah.
He was the baby. And now there's an actual baby.
Yeah. He literally says, as she's going to the hospital, worry about that baby, not this baby in the tree. Right. Like he's her baby in some ways.
Through and through, he's dead. Like, metaphorically, yeah. I think throughout the entire series, you don't get to see it in that way. But you're mentioning the chicken. In his mind, mm-hmm. he's convinced it's the chicken, right? He does that a lot throughout the series where he gets so convinced of himself. Is the ending just fully that? He truly is so dramatic, he sees it that way. And for whatever reason, the 10th episode is where we get into that. I think if we would have seen a little bit more of that, maybe. Like you said, you do get the curses in there. You get little inklings of it, but yeah, the way it swings on that last episode is definitely big, because everyone reacts to him. It's also not like it's just happening to him, like you're saying, other people are experiencing
it.
I also just love what really does it is not our main characters, it's the neighbor dude.
Yes.
What are you doing?
All right, let's talk about one more literal explanation, just being that episode 10, the moments before we see Asher waking up on the ceiling of the house is that moment where he's kind of playing with her pregnant stomach and he says, there's a little me inside of you. And her reaction to that is not to smile. It is to have the most distant, disturbed, faraway look. And if that look is not her under her breath cursing him or thinking about a reality without him, I'm not sure what it is. But is it in that moment that maybe Whitney curses Asher or does something to kind of send him away? So
At this point, everyone and Paramount Plus have cursed Asher.
Yeah, basically. But talking more about the metaphorical aspects of it, there's that one thing that there's that one aspect that we kind of alluded to, that this is Asher being broken up with. He's mm-hmm. being removed from Whitney's life and left in the vast, cold emptiness of space, which is, you know, analogous to the feeling of being alone and being single. Like when you're broken up with, it's not just that you lose a relationship, it's your entire world dissolves. And in this yeah. moment, when she is moving on from him and moving on to her baby, his world is kind of being ripped away from him. So yeah, there's that.
No. I agree with that for sure.
Yeah, which is one way to look at it. The way that I like to look at the ending, though, is I think that what's happening to Asher is sort of a reversal of what he and Whitney are in Española for. That he is now experiencing basically what the residents of Española are experiencing. Because I've this whole reality show that they're doing, where they come into a town that is, you know, not as financially well off, has some like poverty and houselessness and broken down homes. They're coming into this destitute area and sort of imposing their own vision of what would be better. It's like they're trying to solve the situation through their eyes and not consulting with the town. It sort of puts the townspeople of Española in the position that Asher gets put in the end, because he's in this perilous situation. And although there are people offering their help, there's the fire department, you know, throwing a net around him and cutting down the tree. Dougie shows up to try and help. The doula shows up to try to help. None of them are really doing what he's asking for, and they don't realize that they're putting him in even more danger by trying to help him. And that ultimately, his pain gets turned into entertainment and spectacle, the same way that his show turns other people's pain into entertainment and spectacle. For me, I think that's the explanation that feels in line with everything that's come before it. That feels like it's of a piece with what they were doing in those first 9.5 episodes, critiquing the types of people that Whitney and Asher are.
Mm-hmm. To see it in an actual visual medium, even if it's not true, that this is the emotion. Someone is crying
out telling you what they need. This is what it feels
like. Yeah. And people stare at you and then give you the complete opposite. Right. May I ask?
Think about a homeless person on the street who's being ignored by people passing them by, right?
For sure. Then why not her? It's her money.
That's totally fair.
It's her show. I think there's a version of it where it looks like she got out scot-free.
They're totally
because I love that explanation so much. I go, like, why? Yeah. Why did she get free from that? That's the only thing that I can think of. But that's a great.
So if we want to just like get further into that, I think maybe what it could be is related to the fact that she sort of comes from money and she's got this kind of like,
she'll be okay.
She's insulated from the issue a little bit more,
like the houses.
And like, yeah, exactly. Right. And that Asher is more self-made, but he might not be able to withstand the kind of like downfall that she can always return to her parents and be part of that business. So
easily.
Maybe
it's
because he's like, maybe he should know better. You know, there is that moment in the 10th episode where he actually has like an insightful response to the indigenous character deciding to quit art. Like, he is fully aware of the problems that he is a part of in a way that I don't know if Whitney is.
True. I don't think so. I just think that I was about to give him more faith. I was like, I don't think so. Actually, I saw what he did at the beginning for the gambling thing. I think you're on it with she gets the shield. He's the one who gets the punishment when people get caught.
Right.
It's never going to be the hers. It's always going to be these people, the lower levels, who will get the punishment, and they just continue doing it again.
Exactly.
I mean, her parents got caught and they're still fighting her.
Right. Exactly.
Like, that just showed you what the prequel did when it was about them. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, that's the thing that's so exciting about this to me, though, is that all of these explanations make some sort of sense to me. But none of them necessarily are exactly right. And, you know, it may be hard to puzzle and hard to know exactly what to feel about it. But that we can have this kind of discussion about it is so exciting. And I don't think there's a lot of shows on TV that merit this type of conversation. So to me, that makes The Curse an absolute standout. Like, the finale in particular is like an all-timer to me. Even if I don't know if this is my favorite Nathan Fielder project, I might still put The Rehearsal and Nathan For You above this one. Like, I think mm-hmm. he's just a modern master of comedy.
Yeah, I think he's been doing some good stuff, and I think it's pretty simple. What's that Willy Wonka candy that they eat that makes you float?
Shoot, I wish the I had
or whatever it was. That's what it was. That's what he took. That's what I'm setting with. That's why he played the theme in the rehearsal.
Willy Wonka candy that makes you float. Hover Chalk? It's called Hover Chalk?
Of course, yes. I went right in the tip of my tongue.
Yeah, easily. I mean, yeah, if he truly is Willy Wonka, I want to spend more time in the factory. Whatever is coming up next, I'm very excited for it. Any other notes that we should talk about with The Curse before we finish? You know, I was going to mention one other small detail that I thought was really funny, because we discussed the aspect of their charity, Whitney and Asher's charity. And mm-hmm. while sometimes their charity is more in the interest of their own profits, I did think it was funny the whole subplot with the jean store and Whitney continuing to pay for all the stolen jeans in a way that she's trying to not feel like she's persecuting disadvantaged people, but she's creating the situation in which she's like fostering an environment of increased crime because of it.
Genius. When y'all are ready to apply that to where it's actually happening in the real world, magical things will happen. Yeah, profound. You hit it right on the money. You are training people to do bad and you're throwing money to fix a situation because you don't need money at the end for this entire thing. You already have it. It's how do you fix someone when it's not even money that you are going to get? How do you fix someone's ego? You can't. Yeah. That's the scariest thing. That's the real curse.
There we go. I think that's a pretty smart place to end it. So no last thoughts. You enjoyed the show. Did the finale make you enjoy it any less?
It did because of the discussion.
Really?
I meant that in a positive way. I just processed you said less. It made me like it more. It did not make me like it less. The show was so good. I was being honest. It did not matter where they were going to take it. But taking it this way, I thought was pretty profound. Like, it would not have moved off my list. It made it one where you actually get to have a discussion out of it. You get to see different perspectives. And I think if you would have done a regular ending, you don't get this talk. You need to make it so bonkers that then this boring political talk becomes the normality of it. And if that's why they did it,
A++.
So be it. A++. Definitely.
All right. So those are our thoughts on The Curse, but I definitely am curious to hear from the Inner Cuties what you thought of the show in general, of that finale specifically, which of our interpretations makes sense to you, which ones are we talking out of our asses on. Just let us know in the comments down below or shoot us an email, intercutpod@gmail.com. Lots of places to get in touch with us, including across social media at intercutpod, as well as our Patreon, patreon.com/intercutpod, and our Discord, where we chat with y'all folks throughout the week. You can catch a link to that in the description of this episode. You can find more from me at Zshevich across social media, or my videos at Multiplex Show on YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. Art, where can people find more from you?
You can find me over at LME Movies on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff, for every week here on the Intercut Podcast.
You can listen to every episode of the Intercut Podcast on whatever your favorite podcatcher is, or subscribe to us on video at youtube.com/intercutpod, where you can catch our decaffeinated faces. We can use some more coffee, right?
There you go. I did not have enough coffee today.
There we go. And we break down the latest entertainment. Please leave us a comment, like the video. Consider hanging over to iTunes or Spotify to give us that much requested 5-star review. Shout out to our listeners in Germany for putting us on the film review charts out there. And you can catch us throughout the week across social media. You okay there? Do you spill?
Damn near spilled everything. I had more water in here than they had in all of Dune. Damn, bro. I just spilled everything. The curse is on me. That's what I get. One of us cracked it, and I'm getting the punishment now.
But that's all for this week's this episode of the Intercut Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time, I curse you.